Thank you for being here tonight. We are going to be in Genesis chapter 7 and 8. I'm going to read through the verses. I think what I'll do is I'll just read through the notes or read through the verses right here on the notes, which is English Standard Version. And then we're going to come back, and if you look, just take a peek at page 2 and 3. I've got a time chart, and I think it's pretty accurate. I try to compare it to several things and work the numbers out. I'm sure something like that, when you're dealing with that many numbers, there's going to be some kind of an adjustment. But just kind of, one, to understand the text of Scripture, but also to see the detail, how different this chapter is as far, like if you're doing it in your devotions and you're reading the chapter, you know, it's the 600th year of Noah, the second month, the third day, you know, it's just like, what does that mean? And then it goes on, and then it gives you another date, you know, on the seventh month, on the 16th day. And it's like, it doesn't make any sense, you know, when you just read through. But when you break it, if they would stick dates in there, like on November 7th, you know, the certain year of the flood, let's say 2458 B.C., it would make a little more sense. But my point is, this is not a myth. This is not a legend about some strange thing happening. This is precision. It tells you how many days. It tells you how deep the water was. It tells you that how it was drying up, where it was coming from. It's a great story and great detail compared to, especially you get back into the cuneiform tablets and some of the things that are actually legends that have been rewritten and adjusted to different cultures. So here we go. I'll read these verses and make comments as we go by. Chapter 7, verse 10. And after 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the earlier verses there of chapter 7, God tells Noah there's going to be 7 days before the flood. And on those, he's got 7 days to get on the ark. And so sometimes people say Noah sat on the ark for 7 days waiting. That could be if he got on the ark right away with everything. I would assume they're preparing the last 7 days, getting the final animals on. So the animals are on the boat for the least amount of time, getting, you know, the final food preparations, getting things sealed up. And so I would say they have 7 days to get on the ark, and they probably were on several hours ahead of time, if not a couple days ahead of time. And then the waters of the flood came upon the earth. And now what we're going to read is it appears they come from two places. The fountains of the deep burst forth, and the explosion of that is going to send water up into the atmosphere, which is probably going to cause something in the atmosphere that has been placed there to fall down. If nothing else, it's going to freeze as it goes up and come down as frozen water. So you've got volcanic activity bursting forth from the bottom and the continental plates that you see that's heating water up, causing vapor and steam that's going to condense and form rain coming down, but also getting high enough in the atmosphere that it's going to freeze, and probably snow at least, maybe even chunks of ice are falling out. And then, of course, the water on the earth has tsunami effect. It's just washing things out. Here it is. It's going to do that for 40 days. In chapter 7, verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month on the 17th day, and we'll take a look at that again as we come back to it, of the month, so it tells you exactly the year. If we did our timeline here, we can look at the year, you know, if the timeline is accurate using the biblical sources. And we know the month, you're going to have the religious the religious calendar and the civil calendar. We'll be using the civil calendar. Moses is going to institute using the same months, but it's going to begin a new year beginning, a new beginning to the year that's going to be the religious celebration. So there, this is probably matching the second month of the civil calendar, which matches the Sumerians and the months that all these things were written in, because that was the months. And they're going to be months of 30 days. So you're going to have a 360-day year with, you know, an adjustment that's going to have to come about every few years to keep everything on schedule. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heaven were open. So you can see there, it appears, two things. the fountains of the deep burst forth, waters coming up out of the earth, and we know there's water in the earth. There's water in the earth today. There's springs coming up out of the earth today. This was the beginning, the beginning in the Garden of Eden. There was a river that came up out of the earth, not from the mountains, but came up out of the earth and came out. And then it says, and the windows of heaven were open. You could read that just, it started to rain, like there's clouds. Or it does also appear that there's something up there originally that now is collapsing, so that our earth has changed. Remember in the beginning, God placed the atmosphere or the sky, Genesis 1, 2, they talk, Genesis 1, sky between the waters on the earth and the waters above the earth. And so, again, that's not talking clouds, that's something above. So at least keep that in mind. You don't have to accept it. And these things, comments here, I've got written down here. This verse gives two sources of water. I already mentioned that. And then you can see the Hebrew words there. When it says that they burst forth is the same word used in Numbers 16:31, where an earthquake splits the earth and Korah and his followers were swallowed up. Psalm 78:15, where God split the rock. So when it says it burst forth, it's rock splitting apart. It's the earth opening up. There's no doubt about it. At least the meaning of the word. The fountains is the word. It means springs of the deep. And it, here it's identified as Rabbah, the great deep. So the deepest part, not just, you know, surface stuff, but in the great depths of the earth, water came up out of there, and it's going to recede to there, although it's going to be using the same word without the adjective great in front of it. And then it says the windows, the sluice, the lattice, whatever's holding something up, the windows of the heavens opened up or unloaded. So as if something was holding up water, they split apart and it came down. It could be that the atmosphere was structured, you know, gases or however, in such a formation that it was holding water up above it. And when the waters went up, it broke those open, and all the water that was on top came crashing down. That's at least some models follow something like that. And just point D on page 2, it says it is possible earthquakes set off the release of water, pressurized, and I described the same things there. The continental plates, Genesis 10:24 refers to earth being divided. Let's go to page 4 and continue reading the text from chapter 7. We'll take a look possibly at what's on page 4. Those are your two calendars or one calendar. It names the month. If you look at that, the second calendar, the months are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, down through 12. It gives you the Jewish religious calendar. Nisan with the first month, and then the Akkadian calendar or the Sumerian calendar matches. Notice the names of the months are very similar, coming from Samaria, Akkadia, which is Nimrod's country, or Sargon the first country or empire, and the religious or the Jewish religious calendar, and then I put the religious calendars together there. And then I also got the Gregorian calendar, our calendar, to match that. So their first month would be Nisan, which is March. And it's not exactly March. It's the middle of March to the middle of April. And then on the far side, you're going to have the Jewish month and then our Jewish civil calendar. And that is the first month is Tishrei, which if you look down in the Jewish religious calendar, that's the seventh month. So in the civil calendar, September's the beginning of the year, and you can just see they're just offset a little bit there. So that's, again, according to this, if we use the Jewish religious calendar, the Akkadian calendar, the flood began, as I said last week as we were closing, on the 17th day of Noah's 600th year, which would be the year 2458, on our little countdown here, at least close, and that would be the 27th day of the second month of Noah's 601st year, or it ends on the second month, or it ends in 370 days. And we can take a look at that in more detail. Okay, chapter 7, verse 12, page 4. And the rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. And so that gives the idea, it says rain, but the fallout of the continental plates bursting forth, the water coming up, the water coming down, even chunks of ice, frozen water coming down from being frozen in the atmosphere, It continued like that for 40 days, and it's going to continue to fill the earth. So there, it's not just rain, but just this coming of water for 40 days. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast according to its kind and all the livestock according to their kinds and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind and every bird according to its kind, every winged creature, they went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. If there's a miracle in this story, it's the Lord right here shutting him in. Everything else, obviously God's announcing it, God's pronouncing it. But in a sense, it could all just be a natural response of just nature and the pressures of the water and the continental plates of everything happening. So the flood of Noah, we could call it a miracle, but it's really, it seems to be very practical, very scientific. You know, Noah's not just floating in the air like a bird. He's in a boat floating on water. It's big enough to hold the animals. So it's, everything's, in a sense, practical reality. The only thing here, one, you can ask, how did all the animals know how to get to the ark? Which ones came? Did Noah go out and catch them, or did God cause them to come? But here, definitely, it says, and they went into the ark, two by two of all flesh, with the breath of life. Where am I at here? Oh, chapter 7, verse 16, and the Lord shut him in. That seems like something Noah could have done, is pull the door shut himself. And he probably had a plan to shut the door, seal the door, maybe even put some tar around it, like we put caulking around a window for the winter or something. He probably had that all taken care of. This maybe means something more than just physically shutting the door, but somehow God, you know, seals it, protects it, watches over it, because he does have a covenant with Noah that's going to be coming up here again. So in other words, God is watching the ark. Chapter 7, verse 17. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore the ark, and it rose high above the earth. Again, not just floated on the water, but the earth's surface is covered. Any kind of mountains that already existed or high spots are going to be covered up over the water. And so the ark is above the earth everywhere. I mean, the earth is under the water that's covering the earth, and the ark is on top of it. It says the waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters, and the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. Now, we mentioned mountains. Were there mountains on the earth at the beginning? I would assume there's something, but the continental plates moving, there's a good chance there's mountains being formed as the continental plates we talked last week, as they collide, they're pushed from one direction and they're going to collide on the other side, and they're going to hit, but also the pressure is going to cause one of the plates to go under and the other plate is going to go up, forming mountains. And you can still see this, obviously, in the continental plates. And so mountains are going to be formed. Some say they're higher after the flood than they were before. But here it does say, all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered, which would include the mountains that were there to start with, and the mountains that are forming in these continental plates shifting. Anything that's forming, the water's going to be deep enough. Otherwise, theoretically, animals, if they weren't washed out by the tsunami, the animals or people could run to the high mountains that are being formed during the mountains or during the flood. So the flood has to be deep enough. Anything that's being formed has to be covered up at that point. 7 verse 20, the waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits, or 22 feet. Now, this is interesting. Is this just a guess? Is this just part of the story? Or is Noah, as he's going over, is he measuring, you know, is he just in this boat floating, trying to stay alive? Or is he, in some sense, prepared to do some kind of navigation? Has he got a way of measuring? There is ways of measuring the depths of the water. So as he's going over mountains, and he can tell, especially after the 40 days was over and you just got the flood waters covering the earth, they're going to start to recede. but there's going to be a period of time, the first 150 days, the waters are going to fall for 40 days, and then for another 110 days, they're going to dominate the earth, even increasing, maybe still bubbling up out of the deeps or what depth or whatever, but there's going to be 110 days where they're just floating around on the waters and nothing's receding. Then after 150 days, the water's going to start to recede. And so Noah, I'm going to say, this is not a guess, this is not a story, this is, I'll use the word, a scientific measurement that Noah made while he was on the ark. At some point during the flood, he's examining what's the closest we are to the ground. The closest they came to the ground was 22 and a half feet. This is the closest we've come to the top of a mountain as they sailed over it before the waters started to recede. Then eventually it's going to recede until finally they scrape up against one of the mountains, Mount Ararat. It's going to be coming up in the story. So again, this is not a legend. It's a scientific measurement. It's presented that way. And all the flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. And again, there's millions, possibly billions of people on the earth that are just wiped out. Just imagine tsunamis. You've seen movies, you know, hopefully you've never seen it yourself, but just this huge waves coming, just wiping people, just sweeping them into the sea or the flood up on land and just burying them as tsunami and layer of sediment began to settle down on them, thus creating the fossil layers of all these waves of tsunamis of just pushing things down. It's one, you know, some people say it's really the only way of explaining the layers of fossils and how they were active, how they weren't like just laying down and dying. Some of them were eating, some of them were giving birth. I mean, there's all kinds of animals that are just, they're in the active portions of life, just laid down in layers, flood layers, matching the animals that lived in their habitat. And that's why you get different like sea creatures and coming all the way up. Say, oh, this is the evolutionary layer. No, it's layers of life being washed up, tsunami after tsunami being laid down, burying each other suddenly. And again, they say that's how fossils are formed. Is, you know, if it's laying out on the road somewhere, something's going to eat it, it's going to decay, it's going to rot. These things are laid down in full formation. Recently, as you've heard, an interesting point that's come up several times is dinosaur bones, triceratop horns. As they examine these, they're finding them with soft tissue in the bones. That these things are not billions of years old, millions of years old. These things are thousands of years old, preserved, you know, in a fashion that when you get deep into like the triceratop horns in one case, they can actually take out tissue, and under a microscope, it's still flexible. You can still see blood vessels, meaning these fossils of ancient dinosaurs, and it's coming from several different, it's not just one time, it's coming from the secular world, and they don't know what to do with it other than we need to go back and rewrite books, you know. And so people that have doctorate degrees in these areas of paleontheology, your doctorate degree, you need to go back and get re-educated because and who wants to do that? All of your professors that are handing out the doctorate degrees and all the education, it's like, uh-oh, we need to go back and get schooled. And who's going to want to do that? Who wants to give up and say our whole philosophy is wrong? Nonetheless, this flood, and I said it before, it'd be interesting. We have Christian scientists, not the religious, you know, Christian science, but scientists that are Christians that will take this serious. And it seems as if their eyes are just open. It's like, oh, now we can understand. Now these things make sense. Where if you go with, you know, the naturalists, the evolutionists that want to push the story off, they won't think about it this way. So they've got to explain it with their own religious system, which began with Darwin in a sense, which has been outdated, so they've had to rewrite Darwin's theory. It's new Darwinism, new evolution. And it's like they can't accept the account of Noah's flood. And so they somehow have to keep rejecting and trying to answer these problems. It's like having the answer on the board. You know, you're doing a mathematical problem, and the answer is 7. And you've got to do everything you can with the formula to figure out an answer, but it can't be. The only rule is it can't be 7. And so you just got to keep working the formula until you figure out a way of getting a wrong answer every time and say, ah, look, we've made advances. It's like, no, you just got another wrong answer. The answer is 7. But your only policy is whatever you do with the formula, you can't get the answer 7. So good luck, scientists. And so they have to keep twisting and bending things so they can avoid the answer. So you wish sometimes that if you just they've just humbled themselves, and everybody, all including myself, has to humble myself and look at other options, but humble themselves and say, could this function, could this happen, and see what little pieces of the formula would snap together and start making sense. Nonetheless, chapter 7, verse 22, everything on the dry land and in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark. And here's a verse that's important. Chapter 7, verse 24, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So the first 40 days it came, and then for another 110 days it prevailed. So there's a 40 plus 100, 110. So for 150 days, the waters were prevailing. They were coming and then held their ground, held their positions, and held the earth underwater, the whole earth, for 150 days. So nothing is going to survive the flood waters. Now, chapter 8, verse 1. That's the end of chapter 7. Chapter 8, verse 1. But God remembered Noah. Now, that word remembered is important. I've got it in a box right there with your Hebrew text. It's Zakar, Z-A-K-A-R, and that's the root word. I've got it underlined in the Hebrew transliteration. It means remembered. But that word remember, and you can use this throughout the Old Testament. It doesn't refer to God forgetting. It's like, oh, didn't we have something going on down on earth? It's like, oh, we forgot Noah. It's not like he's not recalling Noah. He's not like he forgot it and had to remember. That's why it went on for so many days. It's like, I just forgot about Noah. It has nothing to do with recalling. It's more of him, well, it's a covenant term. It says, but a response to a covenant faithfulness in accordance with a promise made to Noah in chapter 6, verse 18. So whenever it says, and God remembered Israel, or God remembered Moses, or God remembers whatever, God remembers you, he's not recalling because he forgot, but he's now going to re-engage a covenant. We made a covenant, this is what's going to happen, and now we're waiting for these things to develop, and now I'm going to take active action on the covenant. So in remembering Noah, he's made a covenant, I'm going to preserve you through the flood, and you're going to be the source of the new world. This is a new world that's going to be formed, not the new world like we're born again. We're new creatures in Christ, and the reason we call ourselves new creatures or born again or newness of life is because we are prepared or on the way of being. We are born again. We're in the process of having our minds renewed. We will be glorified, but we're on the process of joining the firstborn from the dead, which is Jesus, in his new creation, the new heaven and the new earth, the new creation. We are already prepared for that, are in the process for the new creation. Well, going back to Adam was the first creation. God has now brought judgment, and Noah's going to now be, in a sense, the second creation, and he's remembering Noah and is going to bring him out of the ark. The seed of the woman will continue. The promise of salvation will continue through Noah, and here it says it, chapter 7, verse 17, and the flood continued for, where am I at here? Oh, I'm on the bottom of page 5, okay. And the waters prevailed on the earth for 150 days. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark, and God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. Now again, that means the waters stopped coming up out of the earth, stopped falling from the heavens. So we've got, in a sense, a calm, the winds blowing. And I've got on page 6 these things written down. This is, if you read this, and you can compare to Genesis chapter 1, this is the reversal of the things in the beginning. In the beginning of creation, Genesis 1, this is just a reversal of it. Everything depends on God to change. Here history goes from total destruction to deliverance. And again, I explain the word remember there. Recede is used 4 times, dry is used 3 times. So the water is going to start to recede, and as it recedes, drying is going to take place. So it's going to now take, we're going to have a second 150 days of the recede. Recede, the water is going to recede, and then once the waters recede, the drying process is going to begin. But this receding is going to take 150 days, and so that countdown begins. On the right, on page 6, on the top of the page there, I've got a comparison of 7 days of creation or the with the restoration of the earth in Genesis chapter 8 and 9. And again, you can make connections there. It's worth looking at. But God, what God did in Genesis chapter 1, he's now doing again in Genesis chapter 8 with the things that already exist. Chapter 8, verse 2. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. Notice again, 2 things. The fountains of the deep that burst forth, they were sealed shut. Whatever was above, that stopped falling also. They were closed. The rain from heavens was restrained. And the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. Now, it says that it's going to do this for 150 days, and it says at the end of 150 days, the water's going to have abated. It's going to be gone. But that doesn't mean that that's what happens in this verse. This is now the beginning of the process, and it says it's going to take 150 days for the waters to go away, and then we're going to have a period of where the earth, the ground, is going to have to dry out. You can imagine how muddy it would be. But now we start to describe the 150 days of the water receding. And here again, chapter 8, verse 3, I've got a chart there just using the dates of Noah. I've got the Bible reference, I've got the event, and then I've got the date, which would be the month, the day, and Noah's age. So it began on the second month, the 10th day of Noah's 600th year, get in the ark. The second month, the 17th day of Noah's 600th year, the floods begin. They continue for 40 days, and now you're into the third month, the 26 days. All those are numbers right out of the text of Scripture. Isn't that amazing? All the deeds. Now, some of those you can have to add up certain numbers in the context, but he's giving you, it's going to be a total of 370 days of flood. You add the 7 days that they're told to get on the ark. From the time he says 7 days from now the flood's going to come, there's going to be 377 days, or a full year of the flood, a full year plus 10 days, 360 days. Again, we say 365, which is, you know, the modern calculations, but they would have 12 months of 30 days or 360 and then 10 more. That's how long they were on the ark plus 7 days of loading. So that's, you can see that right there. And we're going to cover that in a little more detail as we wrap up the day tonight. And you can break that down. Bottom of page 6, point 1, 7 days of waiting. Point 2, 150 days of the earth, water prevailing on the earth. Turn the page. 3, 150 days of the water receding, and that's what we're talking about right now. And then there's going to be about a 70 days left to reach the 370 days of the earth just drying out before they actually open the ark up and get out of the ark. So here we go. Chapter 8, verse 4. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, that'd be Noah's 600th year yet, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And so as the waters began to recede, you know, it's now, you know, 22 feet above the mountains. And then it's 20 feet, then 15, and then 10, 12, and pretty soon it's 3 feet. Maybe they can see some, you know, maybe the water's clear enough that they can see going over the tops of some land. And pretty soon it's dropped down where the ark is going to scrape against the side of a mountain, and it's going to land on what it said, Mount Ararat. Now, I've got a map there for you, Mount Ararat. Again, this is going to be pathetic. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Persian Gulf. Here's the Euphrates, the Tigris River. Ararat, would be a mountain range right up here. You can see where it's at. We know where it's at today. It's not a mountain. It's not like that's the mountain. It's more of a range. Those are the Ararat Mountains. So there's all kinds of excavations, and people have had all kinds of great stories. And I have nothing to add to that, or I don't know. There's been things that haven't made sense that people have found. I have somewhere in my notes. I don't have them here tonight. But even in Josephus' account, he records, there's a guy with a name that starts with a B, Borsus or Boris or something like this, an ancient historian that talks about how you could still see the ark in his day, and that people would go and take wood from it and use it for construction and different things. And so Josephus is recording a historian that was talking about knowing where the ark was. Now that's, again, neither here nor there. We're not going to talk about that tonight. All kinds of people looking for stuff, trying to find the remains of it. There's enough stories out there that it sure seems like there's something to it. But at the same time, if there's something to it, and I've seen archaeological sites where we've actually found, or not we, but they found the Pool of Siloam, they found the Western Wall Tunnels, they found, we just keep going through examples. They found Bula, seals with people's names on it, that if there was something legitimate, that somebody would make a big deal about it, or at least set up some kind of a museum or something. So I want to believe some of that stuff, but I have no reason to really embrace it. But nonetheless, that's where it set. Now, the account of Gilgamesh, like here, the flood tablet of Gilgamesh on here, the person that was, his name is spelled U-T. I looked it up a few weeks ago so I could say it. You know how you can look stuff up on Google and have it pronounced for you? And here, I'll try it right here. That's his name. Ut-Nap-Napishtim. That is, in the account of Gilgamesh, that is the guy who was told by one of the gods that all the other gods were going to flood the earth, and he made a boat, kind of like a circular boat, kind of tall, put the animals in it, and the waters came for 12 days, and he sailed the boat around, and he himself landed, according to the cuneiform tablets, and I've got it on there, he landed 400 miles south of here on a mountain called Mount Nisir, N-I-S-I-R, or it's also pronounced Mount Nimish, or not pronounced, but also written this way. This is a mountain right here where the Noah of the Gilgamesh story, that's where his boat landed, and he got off the mountain. And so it's just interesting. This is the biblical account. This is the Akkadian, Sumerian, Mesopotamian account, and that goes long hand with, there's an account, and we've looked at it, referred to last week in China. There's another account over in the Mesopotamian area. Idris got accounts. Of course, I referred to a bunch of North and South American references. In fact, I bought a book this week. There's 300 accounts of some kind of a flood. Sometimes it's close, sometimes it's not very close, but there's similarities. 300 ancient accounts before the Christian literature got to the North and South America that record something like this happened, what we call legends, that if this happened, everybody that came from here would have a story about it. It's not like, the Christians have the market on Noah's flood. It's a Jewish writing that matches cuneiform writings, and so it goes back to, I think, the year 2458 BC, before the Tower of Babel. And there's only one family, so everybody comes from that one family, everybody's going to have an account. It makes sense. Little bit of information, chapter 8, verse 4. In the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Ararat was a large territory that bordered the northern Mesopotamian area. Its boundaries include southeast Turkey, southern Russia, northwest Iran. In this mountainous area in the country of Armenia today, there is a mountain peak that is called Mount Ararat. If it's the exact one, of course, they're going to call something Mount Ararat. It's 17,000 feet high. This verse here says the ark landed not on a mountain peak called Mount Ararat, but in a mountainous region called Ararat. So this area is Ararat. Today you can find a mountain called Mount Ararat in the mountain region of Mount Ararat, but that's because obviously there's going to be a mountain called Mount Ararat since we got the story. But that's not like a sign there and the ark that you can go see. That the ark could exist yet today, that there could be remains of the ark. The things that would support that is it was covered with pitch, you know, tar of some sort. It's not going to decay. It lands in a mountain that's right after the flood. It's going to freeze and it's going to be under frozen or in snow for centuries. And it's made out of gopher wood, which is referred to. We're not sure exactly what it would be, but it's going to be, it's probably not like white pine that's going to decay. It's probably more like a treated lumber of some sort or cedar. Okay, so there's a good chance it could exist. It's not like, you know, you can't say, well, it wouldn't have lasted this long. It certainly could have. Chapter 8, verse 5. And the waters continued to abate. See, we're still talking about the waters going down until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. And now we're going to go back to that chart. Now, at this point, the ark's been sitting on that mountain, but now from here, they can look out. Obviously, they can see the mountain they're sitting on, but now they can start seeing other mountains as they look out over the waters. Mountains are starting to pop up. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. Now, he's going to send out 1, 2, 3, 4 times. I've got that written down right there. He's going to send out a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Now, again, that's rushing ahead of the story. He sends out a raven. A raven goes out first. And again, he sends the raven out. And you know, don't just think, well, the raven just flew away. It's like, well, the raven's gone. It says it flew, went back and forth. The raven is a strong bird. That's why he sends it out. But it's going to continue to fly, and it's a scavenger. If there's, as the water's receding, it could possibly land on some of these mountains that have been exposed and eat some flesh that was left over, possibly, that hadn't, you know, been buried. But nonetheless, it's going to continue to fly, possibly, because the mountains are exposed, it could land, but it's not going to come back. It's just going to continue to fly around and survive. He's going to wait 7 days, and then he's going to send out a dove. Now, a dove is a bird that's going to live. It's going to have to land. It's going to live in the valleys. And so it's going to go out. And, well, you read it right here. Chapter 8, verse 7. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Chapter 8, verse 8. We'll come back and look at some of these details. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. Now, he can see the tops of the mountains, and it's going down every day. It's going down a little bit more. The raven's flying around. They can see that raven flying around, you know, kind of flying by the ark. There's probably somebody on raven watch. Where's the raven? And then they send out a dove to see if the dove is going to find some place, and it comes, flies around, goes, no place for me, and it comes back because the waters are still high enough. And he's waiting 7 days on each one of these. It says, but the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. Mountains are popping up, but there's no place, especially a valley. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. Again, he's probably hoping she goes, makes a nest. He waited another 7 days. And the fact he says another 7 days gives you the impression he's using, and he's going to do it again 7 days. Every 7 days he sends out a bird, sends out a raven, waits 7 days, sends out a dove. The dove comes back. He waits another 7 days, sends the dove out again. And again sent forth the dove out of the ark, and the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So this was not something left over. This was something that has started to grow. So life is starting. It could be growing. Again, right here, olive trees, they're difficult to kill. They resprout easily, and they grow best on, guess where, a hillside, but not on high elevations. So you're not going to find an olive tree on the top of a mountain, but as the water recedes, you're going to get down. The water's still going to be in the valleys or the low spots, but the sides of hills are being exposed. olives are going to start to grow, olive trees are going to start to grow. That would be the idea. So he knows, okay, but he came back, and the dove came back, you know, possibly with the concept, I'm going to start building a nest. You know, I'm going to start building a nest here in the ark or something. But nonetheless, he saw the dove went out and found something in a location the dove was familiar with and brought it back. But it's not ready to go. Then he waited another 7 days and sent out forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. Now this means the dove now has found a place in a valley where they lived in the valleys. They've already got the olives are growing. Price starts building a nest. And now they realize we're getting close. And then chapter 8, well, I skipped some notes here. I'm not sure if there's anything we want to look at. Oh, yeah, on page 7, just because we talked about Utnapishtim, you know, the Noah of the Gilgamesh story, just so you know, and again, we could spend weeks going over the legends, but page 7.3, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the dove and the swallow returned because they could not find a place to perch. But the raven sent out by Utnapishtim does not return. Here's the details. And A, B, C, D. Here's from the Epic of Gilgamesh talking about the Noah of that story. Now, in this story, this guy is going to go live alone, have his own place, and he's going to be very, very old, and people are going to go to visit him, cross oceans or waters, seas to go visit this guy and others that lived through the flood that come from. Now this guy, we're talking about not the Bible, we're talking about the flood legends. There's people like the Noah or the Shem, his son, that was alive hundreds of years after this flood took place in these epics. And people will travel to go meet with them because of the wisdom, the insight. They think they've got a source, a key to eternal life because they come from the world before the flood. These guys right here, just like we think about Noah and his kids like a Sunday school story. But imagine Noah and his sons in the real world. They would be legends. Noah had lived 600 years in the world before the flood. His sons had lived 100 years about before the flood. And now they're on this side of history living another 200, 300, 400, 500 years, including his sons. It's like, and they can tell stories, not just what they heard, they can tell stories about what they saw, what they did, what the world, what the technology, how they built the pyramids. I made that up. I mean, they'd have all that information. So people would travel in these epics. They would travel to visit the one that came from the previous world before the flood, which would be like, you know, Abraham going to visit, you know, Noah or something, or Shem. Okay. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, Utnapishtim, if you want to, anybody want to take a shot at it, say it correctly? I'm not a good reader. Okay. Maybe you're not even paying attention. That's fine, too. He sends out birds to find land after the ship lands on Mount Nisher following the great deluge. First, sends out a dove after 12 days of the water. I mean, it only fell for 12 days instead of 40. He opens the hatch of his ship and sends out a dove to see if the water had receded. The dove returns, having found no place to roost. He then sends out a swallow, which also returns. Finally, he sends out a raven which circled around and does not return. Now, that's the story in the Gilgamesh tablet. It's just interesting how close it is, but how Noah's story makes a lot more sense, sending out the raven just to see where it's going to land, especially since it can eat scavenger off the mountaintops, and the doves keep flying out until they settle, apparently, in a valley. Okay, chapter 8, verse 13 on page 8. In the 600th year... in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, so now we're in Noah's 601st year, the waters were dried from the earth, off the earth, and Noah removed the covering. He'd opened the window before. Now he removes the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. Now, this doesn't mean it's not muddy. It means the water is gone, but they're going to stay on the ark for a period of time yet. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, so you can see that would be a 1 month and 27 days later, the earth had dried out. So you've got a month and 27 days that they've got the cover off and they're looking, but they realize we can't get off, otherwise you're just going to sink. We've got to release all these animals. They're all just sinking in the mud. Then God said, go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. Again, God's intention for man to multiply and fill the earth, the same thing he wants them to swarm the earth. He wants animals everywhere. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. And then we'll pick up chapter 9. But I want to do this right now if there's time. Go back to page 2. And I'm not sure how useful this is. But I try to break this down, and we refer to these dates and stuff as we're going. But the first column is the biblical verse, Genesis 7 and 10. It says, in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. And then the next verse, after 7 days the waters on the flood came upon the earth. Now, this is the 7 day of announcement. That day, if I do my calculations correct, the day God said that would be the second, well, not, it says right there, it's the second month, the 10th day of 2458. Then the gray box, that first gray box is the beginning of the first 150 days. That 150 days comes to an end about three rows down where there's a gray box. That's the end of the 150 days. Turn the page, and the top gray box is the beginning of the second 150 days, where the waters recede, and going all the way down, you can see all the way down until the next gray column or row, that's the end of 150 days. So all those are the details that take place in the receding of the waters. But yet you've got two more rows, and that is now the water has receded, but you've got to wait for the ground to dry. So then Noah removed the covering, and now you're going to wait 14 days. And some of those numbers I'm getting, they waited 16 more days for the waters to recede, and then 14 days of drying is because you've got to do the numbers of what fits in the 150 and what fits up until the end. And so there's going to be a period of 14 days plus 56 days where the earth is drying up, making a total of 7 days for the earth to dry. So you've got these periods right here on that chart. You've got that first gray row is 150 days of the waters coming. Then you've got 150 days of the waters receding. Now the waters are all gone, but then you're going to have 70 days of the ground drying up, giving you a total of 370 days. And so the flood is going to last 370 days, and that's basically how it all works out. You can say 370 days if you want to add the 7 days that they were told to get on the ark. You could say if Noah got on the ark right away, he sat on the ark for 377 days. I don't think that's the case. I think they spent the 7 days getting everything on the ark, make sure it's all closed up and ready to go. But they've 370. So 150 days of the water increasing. The first 40 days was the fountains of the deep and the heavens falling down, but the water continued to rise. Then it stops and starts retreating, receding for 150 days. And then after the water's gone, they take the cover off. They just sit on the ark, waiting for everything to dry out. This is the period of drying right there. That is, again, seems very logical, very organized with dates, and that's what you see on this chart. I'll read through it very quickly. On page 2, the first gray box, for 7 days I'll send rain for 40 days, so it's the 600th year. Here's where I got the date. Here's the date I figured out, and I could go through and figure out all the dates, but this would be November 6th, the year 2458 BC. that would be the date. Again, I wouldn't bet my life on that. I would go with the biblical numbers, but now to translate those into what we could match up with the Gregorian calendar we use today, that would be the date, again, if it's right or wrong. So that's the 40 days the waters are prevailing. And then the next, it says, the rain fell for 40 days and 40 nights. The floods continued for 40 days and 40 nights. That's day 1 through 40. And then you're going to have 110 days where the water is going to continue on the earth. And well, that figures out to be Friday, April 4th, 2457, exactly 5 months of 30 days of the flood increasing. So you had 5 months of water increasing on the earth. Turn the page, page 3. Chapter 8, verse 2 and 3, the fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from heavens was restrained and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. Now, that doesn't mean that verse says, now we're going on what happens after that. Now it describes in those white rows what those 150 days, that's now we're describing this 150 days, and here's what takes place. The waters are going to recede. The seventh month on the 17th day, the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. And then you're going to have 13 plus 30 days plus 30 days or 73 days until you get to the 10th month on the of the first day. Now the tops of the mountains were seen. So you got to have a period of apparently about 73 days of where the water's receding and now they can start seeing the tops of the mountains. And then at the end of another 40 days, Noah opened the windows. And now you're at, you know, you can see the days right there. And then he starts sending out the dove or the raven and the doves. And you got a period of 7 days. The day he opened the windows, he sent out the raven. And then you've got 7 days plus 7 days plus 7 days. And then the dove doesn't come back. But they still have to wait 16 days to get to, if you're doing the math, the dove doesn't come back, but they still wait 16 more days before they say, okay, now the water's gone. They can still see water, but now they can see there's no more water and the doves hasn't been back for 2 weeks. Then Noah removes, now we're into the period of drying right here. And now Noah removes the cover, waits 14 days, and then in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried up, and you can do the math and figure it out. So it's 14 days plus 56 days, and now the earth is dried out, and you've got a total of 370 days adding together, and that's the details of how that all works out, which, again, is kind of precise and kind of amazing when you consider people want this to be a legend, and it seems very much like, again, a journal entry, like this was written not by Moses just making something up, but Moses using some kind of diary that was kept on the ark that was handed down, and was a copy was kept with Abraham, went to Egypt with Jacob, and was kept with the Israelites until Moses led him out in the wilderness. And he's got access to all these records and compiles the book of Genesis. So it's really not that, if the event happens and it can make sense, it's not that amazing that we've got a written document from the ark itself recording these things. Now, Ashurbanipal, one of the Assyrian kings that came against Israel, you think, 750 BC, he prided himself. A lot of those guys couldn't write or read themselves, not like the scribes. They had scribes that would do all the work for them. But he realized, like Nebuchadnezzar, that the magicians and the scholars, they could lie to you. And so Ashurbanipal decided, I am going to learn how to write cuneiform myself, and I'm going to learn how to read so I can read history. I can read the things that people are handing around. And one, so he doesn't get assassinated, so he can keep track of things. But he would boast that he could have conversations with the scribes, that he could discuss history because he was educated himself. But he goes on and says that he was able to read, in his own writings, it recorded, that he says, I can read the writings that were written before the flood. This is Ashurbanipal of the Assyrians saying, I have the ability to read cuneiform. I can even read the writings from before the flood. So which would indicate that Noah would have taken some of these things, not the flood accounts, but some of these writings he could write himself, would have put them on the ark, and then handed them off, and they would have been handed down. Even the Assyrians refer to, like I said, reading materials that was written before the flood, and someone would have had to preserve it. Well, okay, next week we'll pick up in chapter 9 and continue through Genesis, and I appreciate you being here. I hope you're learning, enjoying, and it's making sense to you, and you're finding some kind of encouragement. The point of encouragement for me is there was a destruction that God sent to begin a new age, and in the New Testament, Jesus, Peter, refer to that event as an example of the second coming, that Jesus himself is going to intervene. We're not left here alone just in the craziness of the world, that at the right time, at the appointed time, God's got it set. We're not going to cause it to happen. We just need to be prepared to live and do our job until that event takes place, whatever it happens. But Jesus is once again going to come and bring deliverance, bring salvation, but also bring judgment and destruction on the earth. Just like in the days of Noah, so will it be in the future. So we have that to look forward to, which would hopefully include our deliverance and our salvation. But we may face some times of persecution and confusion while we wait for those days. Just like Noah surely had to live in some days of confusion and chaos because the world was so wicked that God was going to destroy it. I'm sure Noah wasn't living just his best life now in a crazy world that God was just moments away from wiping out because they were so wicked. I'm sure Noah had some struggles. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for the hope that you've given to us in Jesus Christ and the trust that we can place in your scriptures. We ask that we would, again, rely on you to lead and guide us, to provide for us, both in our area of salvation and in our physical needs, that we can trust you and keep us doing the things you've called us to do by the power of your Spirit, by the power of your Word, and by the fellowship we have with other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.